All right, let's make sure we are in fellowship and continue on here dealing with this issue of Category 2 love, the love in family, husbands, wives, parents, children, all of that. We started sub-point 8 here under B, Category 2, love and love for children. Sub-point B here, while the Bible commands that children are to be respectful and obedient to their parents, such is not always the case. We recognize that. Those are just two commands in the family codes that tell children to obey their parents. Ephesians 6:1 and Colossians 3:20. And then C, in such cases of disobedience, natural affections and emotional considerations need to be overruled. And both parents are required to administer consistent discipline, which must begin very early in the child's life. Proverbs 13:24. He who withholds his rod, again, corporal discipline when needed. It doesn't mean every offense certainly isn't a corporal offense. Every offense doesn't need a spanking. And you deal with children to some extent, obviously based on their age and their comprehension and all of that. You will have to discipline a two-year-old because the first word, probably even before that, because the first word they'll learn is no. And you can't tolerate that. You've got to start shutting that down. And it requires consistent, every time, deal with it. If the child starts thinking he's getting away with stuff, that will only increase. It won't get better. He who withholds his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. The Hebrew there has the idea of diligently, i.e. regularly, as often as necessary, or even early. With children, by the time, you'd be surprised at what a baby understands. There's no magic age where they, you know, because kids walk at different ages and they talk at different ages and all of that. And their understanding varies depending upon a number of factors. But children know more than you think they do. And they don't call them the terrible twos for nothing. It's a fact that that's one. If you don't start dealing with it by that time, though, you'll lose the child by the time they're 5 or 6. The damage will have been done. And people who wait until they're teenagers to start disciplining them, well, that's way too late, sadly. So consistent verbal instruction coupled with physical discipline, point D, as needed, is the standard espoused by the Word of God. And again, physical discipline doesn't include abuse, doesn't include slapping, screaming, hitting, phone cords, wire coat hangers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It surely doesn't include hooking them up to batteries and shocking them or tasing them. You might want to, but you shouldn't. That's abuse. And so, again, the child was made with a place to be spanked. It connects right to the brain, strangely enough, and can get results way quicker than a bunch of, you know, this business of you're going to, you know, the Doc Spock approach is proven to be catastrophic. Don't thwart the child. Whatever you do, let him express himself and all of that. Well, that doesn't work. That doesn't work at all. The children need boundaries. They need parameters. A child with too much freedom will get himself into trouble. There's just no question about it. And it's been demonstrated thousands of times. So consistent verbal instruction coupled with physical discipline is the standard espoused by the Word of God. Deuteronomy chapter 6. And again, what is taught here, we espouse. We have, when we have had need, provided for a prep school when we had kids that were younger and all of that. But at a point, you want them in Bible class. They need to be in the same environment. Other people are. But until they are capable of keeping up, and obviously they got to learn vocabulary and some things and all that. So That's appropriate, but that's always just viewed as a supplement. The parents are the primary responsibility on this. The church is not. Never has been. We can provide supplemental instruction, but that's only designed to complement what the parents are supposed to be doing. So Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7, these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house. Almost every opportunity in life is an opportunity to teach a particular doctrine. And it may not be all the time. And you don't want to become heavy-handed with this as a parent where, you know, everything is just doctrine, 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 doctrine all the time. I mean, it is a lifestyle. I get that. But you don't want kids to feel like they're just being bludgeoned. And sometimes parents have done that, use doctrine as a club. That's not helpful. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your houses and gates, so that constantly these people were in an environment where they're constantly exposed to God's commandments, God's word. And that's how you want to raise kids. You want to provide an environment where that is the environment they grow up in. Also, Proverbs 29:15. The rod and reproof give wisdom. First, verbal instruction. I'm not sure why rod comes here first, because any parent, any normal parent, is going to instruct the child verbally and give a verbal warning that if this happens again, there's going to be trouble. But then the parent has to be consistent. If he don't make threats, you don't follow through with as a parent. It doesn't serve you. So the rod and reproof. Reproof is just telling the child he's wrong. Well, we don't want little Johnny to grow up thinking he's wrong or has any problems. The business of participation trophies, that needs to go, period. That's as stupid as anything I've ever seen. This sends all the wrong signals to children that success or winning in an athletic competition is the same as showing up. It is not. That's astonishing that people even think that. But a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother's, to his mother. And kids can be headstrong. I was a headstrong little kid. I got into a lot of trouble by the time I was 8 years old. And so I won't tell you all of it. But, you know, none of it's probably too shocking, the kind of things you'd expect out of little kids. You know, I cussed. I got in trouble for that. You know, they don't want you using profanity in the house. I got my mouth washed out with soap. Told my mom she wasn't big enough to do it. She was. I learned the hard way. I didn't develop a taste for it like the boy in the Christmas story did. And, he became quite the connoisseur. Well, I was a headstrong little boy. What a shock. Got in trouble. Got caught smoking. Actually, we didn't actually even get caught. I think somebody told on us. Some adult saw us and then mentioned it to my dad, I guess. Got in trouble for that. And I was taught, and I don't think I ever really got in trouble for it, but I was taught early on, you can't hit your brothers. You can, you know, they may make you crazy, but you're not allowed to hit them. You're bigger than they are, and so, you know, you can't do that. So I didn't ever get too much in trouble for that because I knew I would get in trouble. But, you know, All the guys here have been a little boy once. You remember being a little boy? The way you thought? The things you try to get away with? If you thought you could get away with it, you might try it. It depended. But again, a headstrong child is a problem. You have to corral that in. It's got to be put within the proper boundaries and kept there. You discipline them consistently, and then we've seen Ephesians 6:4, that's obey your parents. See, the parents must deal with the problem of the child's sin nature consistently and cannot allow themselves to be deterred by the child's tears. I know anytime I got in trouble, You know, my dad would always ask this one question, when are you going to obey me? Now. I've got the picture. We don't need to go ahead with the spanking. Now, Dad, now. Well, my dad was smart enough to know, no, you still need discipline, and gave it to me. But they were never abusive. I always got spanked on the butt. I didn't get, you know, they didn't get slapped or screamed at or any of that, you know. And normally it was with a belt. I remember one time Dad didn't have his belt with him, and I smarted off or did something. I can't remember. I did so many things wrong, you know. But he said, go over there to that willow tree and get a switch and bring it to me. It's like carrying your own cross, you know. That's the way I thought about it. I got a willow switching once, and it hurt, but it didn't hurt very long, you know. And I survived it. I wouldn't recommend people do that now, but you got a belt. And really, when they're little, when they're babies, you just need a hand is all you need. And then maybe a wooden spoon later, but you don't whack them in the head with it. You know, again, there's a place to be spanked. So Proverbs 23:13. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with the rod, he will not die. He may scream like he's going to die. You may convince the neighbors you're killing him, but the fact is that's not the case. And so this idea that if you spank children, you're abusive, that's all wrong. That's human viewpoint. That's satanic, in fact. That will destroy a family. A child left to run amok, that doesn't work out to anybody's advantage. So the parents, F, are the first line of instruction and defense against the sin nature. Failure to fulfill that responsibility brings shame on the parents and discipline on the child. 22:15, that one we may have seen, I don't remember. Oh, no, we haven't, but it's true. Foolishness, stupidity is bound up in the heart of a child. And the fact is, you're having to deal with their heart, their inner person, their innermost being. Not their physical heart, obviously. But the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. You can kick that foolishness out of, not literally kick it, but you can discipline the foolishness out of a child to where they're not stupid as they used to be. And you should. Because a child that's left to himself at some point is going to engage in behavior so risky, it could be deadly. They don't have any sense. And I'm astonished at, you know, even grown people. I knew this guy, he was in his 20s, dove into an above-ground pool head first and paralyzed himself. How stupid do you have to be to dive into an above-ground pool? I mean, that's not a child. That's a grown man. And so, but if a grown man's dumb enough to do it, you know a child's dumb enough to do it. And they do. And I watch the things people do. There was a cop. I saw a deal. You know, I watch enough of the news to kind of keep up with what's happening. And a cop was stopping this guy the other day on a bridge. And all of a sudden, you see the car's still rolling, but he jumps out, takes three steps across, and dives over the side of the bridge. I assume there was water down there because they went and got him. But it was dark. He didn't look. If there had been rocks down there and he landed on head first, that is just stupid. And if adults are dumb enough to do that, where do you think they learned that behavior? It was been ingrained into them by then. First, I was taught very early on, you're polite with the police. It's yes, sir, and no, sir. And you sure don't run from them. You run from a cop, you deserve anything you get, up to and including getting shot. Because this is just tolerated. The problem is the society is just about gone, frankly. Our culture has just about had it. You look at what the adults are doing, and it's no wonder children are so messed up. The adults above them are. So foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Also 29, 15 and 17. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. And then verse 17, correct your son and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Children having a great capacity and an ability to really make their parents happy. An obedient, adjusted child, well, number one, it's so rare anymore. But to see it is refreshing. Children that are younger people that are obedient, that are cordial, that are kind, that will engage you. You know, I went to pick up some chicken the other day at Popeye's, and when I walked in, there was nobody at the counter. You know, I could see one guy back there working, but there's nobody at the counter. I finally, after I stood there for a minute and kind of said, "Hey," and so he said, and I hear him turn around and say something to some girl. She comes around walking out on her phone. I said, "You know, you really shouldn't be on your phone while you're at work." She did. She glared at me like if she could have killed me, it looked like she would have. For just saying something that simple. That this is not how society operates, or it shouldn't be. When you're on the job, you're there to serve the customer. And by the way, I didn't bother telling her because I saw the look on her face and I thought, I don't know what she's thinking, but it was not kind. It wasn't thank you, sir, for pointing that out. She looked like she wanted to kill me, literally. I mean, the look in her eyes was brutal. And I just thought, this shouldn't be this way. And by the way, I'm right. I'm the customer. I'm the guy who pays your salary. People they have the wrong ideas out there about what's what. And their parents apparently never taught them. So correct your son and he will give your comfort. He will also delight your soul. And an obedient, a well-adjusted Christian child, they're a pleasure. And now they grow up to be well-adjusted Christian adults. And a child that isn't, it's just a heartbreak. It is just heartbreaking. That's just the nature of the beast. So parents that will not effectively follow through in this area also demonstrate that they do not actually love their child. Protest to the contrary, notwithstanding. Proverbs 13:24. So to claim you love your child and then you won't discipline them when they need it is just a lie. You're delusional. You fooled yourself into believing something that isn't true. He who withholds his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. And the idea of hate isn't just, you know, people tend to see the word hate and they tend to think active hate. Withholding your rod is just ignoring the problem, isn't it? It's not active hate. You're just ignoring it. And that's the same as hatred. If people ignore God or they actively hate him, which is worse? At least you know where the one who actively hates him stands. He may claim he doesn't, but he does. He actively hates God. And then 18. Discipline your son while there is hope. And believe me, that hope is not very long-lived. It's before they get to be teenagers. There's hope. There's time. And do not desire his death. So normal physical discipline does not include physical abuse. And it should not include oppressing the child with unrealistic expectations or demands. Colossians 3:21. Fathers, and I believe this command, and this can apply to mothers too. I've seen mothers do this, drive their children, push them to excel, push them to go in a particular direction in life and all of that. I've seen that. That's not any good either. But fathers tend to, I think, be more prone to this. And that's why Paul addresses them. Do not exasperate your children so that they do not lose heart. You don't want to get them, depress them. Eventually, they'll just get depressed and throw in the towel. You have to tailor what you expect out of the person to their capabilities. And in certain cases, and in any area of life, not just with children and parents, but in every area of life, no matter what you take on, anything new, you're going to have a learning curve that goes with that. You don't automatically go out and do something and you suddenly know everything about it. You have to learn. And that's to be expected. And the same thing's true with children. Children have to learn. When I started at Whataburger, I didn't know anything about the fast food business. And they didn't trust me to know anything. That's why I ended up peeling onions. How smart do you have to be to peel onions? And but I know today I've watched people on their jobs. You know, you see them when you go in and interact with them and all of that. And you can tell if people like doing their job or doing it from their soul, or if they're just going through the motions and wish they weren't there. Sometimes the look on their face will tell you, yeah, I wish I wasn't here. I'm just here to get that paycheck. No, a job well done is satisfying in and of itself, if done right. So don't exasperate them. Tailor your commands to their abilities. And recognize they're going to fail. Okay, that's fine. You can make a mistake. We're not going to kill you if you make a mistake. But we will point out, hey, you don't want to make that same mistake again. That's the kind of deal. So what it does entail is verbal instruction that defines the parameters of behavior. Verbal warnings as to the consequences of disobedience and the appropriate physical discipline when the child chooses disobedience. And never let it be lost on you as a parent that the child's making choices. He's got volition. He's constantly making choices. And the choices can be good, bad, or otherwise. But for most children left to themselves, they're going to be bad. That as a general rule. You might have that exceptional child that's really a go-getter, a self-starter, and will do everything that is necessary. But other than that, you have to tell them, okay, here's what we expect. And parents should define, again, the parameters of what's tolerable, what's not tolerable. If I tell you to be at home by 10 o'clock, I don't mean 10:15. I don't mean when you want to come in. I mean this is when you better be here. If you're not here, there'll be consequences. And then, obviously, one of the things parents do, or they certainly can and have, and that is to make threats that they don't follow through with. That is a huge mistake in any area of life, but especially with children. Because once they figure out you're weak, they've got you. They know you won't follow through because you don't like spanking them. Nobody likes it. I didn't like it. But I also knew that it was necessary. And again, all parents, you know, we're all just practicing. We didn't come, you didn't get an instruction manual other than the Bible as to how to deal with children. And so we're all learning on the job as we go. And so parents are going to make mistakes. But the child that grows up and then blames all his problems on the mistakes the parents made, that's not acceptable either. I'm not saying parents don't make mistakes, they do. But in the end, everybody's responsible for their own behavior. And that includes kids. So three here, category three, love for personal friends. One, this aspect of love is best demonstrated by the relationship of David and Jonathan. 1 Samuel 18. One through four. And it came about that when he had finished speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved David as himself. And so Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house, that is David. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. And so this was basically a relationship of great friendship. They were like brothers under the skin, we might say. And then Jonathan honored David because he's obviously the prince. He's the son of the king. When he gave him the royal robe that was on him and gave it to David, and along with his armor. Also, 2 Samuel 1:26. This is probably at the death of Jonathan, I suspect. This is when Saul and Jonathan died. Now, Jonathan, unfortunately, never separated from his father. He continued to stick with him over the years and ultimately paid the price for it. He died with his father. I don't know. Jonathan should have been there with David, but he wasn't. He says in verse 25, How have the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. Guess what modern interpreters want to turn this into? Can you guess? Homosexuality. As if that's what David means. He doesn't mean that at all. He recognized that the relationship was as satisfying to him as sex was to most men. And that kind of relationship, you don't have very many of those ever in life. You get very few of these. And they are critical. They are important. So too, a true friend loves consistently at all times. Maintaining loyalty and allegiance to his friend, personal failures notwithstanding. Proverbs 17:17. And if you've ever had a long-term relationship, you know, it probably, like most things in life, it's cyclical at some level. I mean, there's an underlying sameness to it. But it kind of comes and goes. You'll have times when you're closer with a person than not. Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. And then also 18:24. A man of too many friends comes to ruin. Oh, I got hundreds of friends. Well, as he said in Tombstone, I don't. I got lots of friends, Doc. Well, I don't. And he wasn't a very easy guy to get along with, Doc Holliday. And he said, Wyatt Earp is my friend. And that's the reality. But a guy that has too many friends is popular with everybody. Well, one, he probably doesn't stand for much if you're popular with the masses, because that which is highly esteemed among men is often an abomination to God. But there is a friend. Who sticks closer than a brother. So three, a real friend can be counted on to respond in adverse situations or during unexpected times of testing. Luke chapter 11. Verses 5 through 8. This is an encouragement. Of course, the story here is one to encourage consistency in prayer and not giving up. And he said to them, suppose one of you has a friend and goes to him at midnight and says to him, friend, lend me three loaves. You better know me pretty darn well to show up at midnight, for one thing. And that's true in this situation too, of course. But anybody from class should be able to do this. If you had a real catastrophe, it doesn't matter what time it happens. For a friend of mine has come to me from a journey, and I have nothing to set before him. They're hungry. I don't have any food. And from inside, he answers and says, do not bother me. The door is already shut, and my children and I are in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything. And I tell you, even though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend, yet because of his persistence, he will get up and give him as much as he needs. So I presume the guy stands out there and keeps knocking until he gets what he wants. And that's kind of the lesson behind this, because this is a lesson about persevering in prayer. That you don't give up. Because again, God's going to answer your prayers in one of three ways. Yes, no, maybe. Or later. Not maybe, but later. It may be a timing factor. But he might answer immediately in the affirmative or in the negative. So a true friend does not slander or malign. On the other hand, he can be counted on to tell his friend what he needs to hear, even when it's painful. And this is a challenge to be a good friend. Psalm 15:3. And this is a psalm essentially about what it means to be a mature believer that God approves of. What is it that God's looking for? As he says, O Lord, in verse 1, who may abide in your tent? In other words, who's going to have fellowship with God? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Who's going to be welcome there? Well, he who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor. Now, we've all said and done things we shouldn't, that we've all gossiped or maligned. I don't think anybody's ever escaped that particular sin. If you have, good for you. But all of us have done this. But again, taking up a reproach, he does not take up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a reprobate is despised. God says part of being a mature Christian is that you don't tolerate evil. That's a part of this. But he honors those who fear the Lord. And also Proverbs 27. Six and nine. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. And I believe there, if I remember right, that word is bruises. So it means it means a pretty good wallop. And he's not talking, of course, about physical altercations here. He's talking about the mental and emotional wounds you get sometimes when you hear things you don't want to hear. People tell you things that you don't want to deal with. And all of us can be guilty of that. But deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. An enemy may make over you like something, but he's got another agenda, trust me. But again, so it's better to have somebody who will tell you the truth and deal with it than somebody who will flatter you and make you feel good about yourself when in fact you shouldn't. So 6 there, and also verse 9, oil and perfume make a heart, make the heart glad. So a man's advice is sweet to his friend. And so as a believer, you want to try to, if you ever called on, you want to be somebody who gives good advice, who knows the doctrine, who can articulate it, bring it forth when necessary. As he says, a man brings forth out of his treasure some things new, some things old. Maybe a doctrine that's new, maybe something new to the person, or it may be something you've heard 100 times but need to be reminded of. Again, he can be counted on to tell his friend what he needs to hear, even when it is painful. That's the bruising part. 5, a real friend is not influenced by one's wealth or lack thereof. However, this is not the standard by which many people operate. There are many people in the world who will simply suck up to somebody because they got money. I've seen this, I've watched it, I find it personally disgusting that people do this. But I've seen it, they will be, the guy who picks up the tab at dinner has a lot of friends. And that's not really always appropriate, sadly. So Proverbs 19:4, wealth adds many friends. Hey, you want to find out how many friends you got, win the lottery and let your name get out there. They won't be friends, by the way, though. They'll just be people coming looking for money and to try to get you to do what they want you to do. So wealth adds many friends, not in reality. It does superficially. But a poor man is separated from his friend. And I don't know how many times I've heard it. I think I heard it from MC Hammer and many of these other rock stars who made a lot of money, got real successful, then had this entourage, people hanging around until the money ran out. Then they abandoned them and didn't have anything to do with them. They were just there for the money and what it could provide, of course. Not because they were really friends. Not because they necessarily even liked the guy. But once you go through all that, you find out who your friends are. Adversity is a real way to find out, in fact. Also, verse 6, many will seek the favor of a generous man. And every man is a friend to him who gives gifts. Hey, if you want to take me on vacation and pay for my trip, I'll be your friend. You want to buy me a new car, I'll be your friend. You want to pay off my credit cards, I'll be your friend. But I've seen people who engage like this. I'm being facetious because I wouldn't do any of that. But I've seen people who do operate that way. And I found it kind of disgusting. Trying to take advantage of people's good nature. You don't want to take advantage of people's good nature. It's one thing to have a physical need. That's not taking advantage if it's an actual need. Proverbs, also verse 7, all the brothers of a poor man hate him. And how much more do his friends abandon him? He pursues them with words, but they're gone. Why? Because he doesn't have any money. Can't help them. Can't give them what they're looking for. Which isn't really friendship. It's financial blessing or physical blessings. So, the maximum category of the maximum expression, rather, of category 3 love is physical sacrifice. John chapter 15. John 15, 13. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. That's the maximum expression of this. And Paul says in Romans, he said, most people will not do this. The people will not tend to die for anybody. But there might, he qualifies it and said, there might be exceptions. But as a rule here, and Jesus obviously manifested this at the highest level possible. Because he tells him, you are my friends if you do what I command you. But I no longer call you slaves. For the slave does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you as friends. See, the master in a normal environment, the master just tells the slave what to do. He doesn't explain himself. The slave has no insight into the bigger picture. The master doesn't care. He just wants the slave to do what he's told him to do. But Jesus says, you know, I don't call you slaves now. I have called you friends. Because I've shared the innermost workings of my ministry with you. What the Father is about here in the human race, you're a part of now. For all the things that I have heard from the Father, I have made known to you. And that's a part of friendship, and a part of that, of course, is self-revelation of you know one another. So 7, neither category 2 nor category 3 love is to take precedence over the principles of the truth, even when it involves immediate family or the closest of friends. Inordinate loyalty to others may cause the believer to compromise the greater priority of his love for God. That always is the prime priority. That is the number one directive. Love the Lord your God. Deuteronomy chapter 13. Verses 6 through 8. If your brother, your mother's son, or your son, or your daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend who is as your own soul entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the people who are around you, near you or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end, you shall not yield to him or listen to him. And your eyes shall not pity him, you shall not spare or conceal him, but you will surely kill him. This was in the society of Israel, the false teachers and all of that, serving other gods. The first commandment, you will love the Lord your God and him alone. You will have no other gods before him. Anything that violates that is something that will ruin a society. If you want to have a Christian society, and this is what is really part of the problem in our world today, there is so much anti-Christian sentiment out there that is expressed because people have embraced anti-Christian things. They've embraced Islam. They've embraced all these foreign religions, Buddhism, all of that, the Eastern religions. There's some that embrace just flat-out insanity, Christian Science. L. Ron Hubbard, Scientology, these aren't even real religions. But the fact is, people embrace them. And they don't want a Christian. As a matter of fact, there's no secret about it. Many of them are articulating, we don't want a Christian society. And their views for talking about a Christian society are white, middle-class, privileged males. That's what they view as a patriarchy. That's their view of a Christian society. Well, first, that isn't a Christian society necessarily. But the fact is, they've embraced all these other ideas, thoughts, religions, and it turns out demonic thinking, human viewpoint thinking. And they've said, look, we don't want this in our culture. They don't like the idea even of Christian schools where certain things are taught that are a part of the nation's Christian heritage. The nation didn't descend from Islam or Buddhism or anything else. This nation was founded on the real reality of freedom to practice Christianity apart from governmental interference. That's why it was made. Far from the reaches of kingdom and pope. That's what the country was looking for. That's why it was founded. Let's get back to that. And go and some of these people, they don't bother reviewing history. They're going to repeat it because they don't know history. That's why they're advancing socialism and communism and all of these things. They don't know history. They don't know what the Bolshevik Revolution was about because they weren't taught that in school that day. They were taught about DEI. You're going to get where you are in life by virtue of your skin color, your sex, your sexual orientation. This is how we're going to identify you, and this is how you'll get ahead. Not because you're a believer and a Christian and you serve God. They don't want any of that. And so he warns that this can come, these attacks can come from anywhere, even the closest of relatives. And they have to be dealt with ruthlessly at some level. And as a believer, this is one of the things that some people have. They've got this loving Jesus in their mind who's never ruthless. He's ruthless when he has to be. I guarantee you when he returns at the second advent, they're going to find a real ruthless Jesus. He's not going to be the one who came. I mean, he will be the one who came and paid for their sins. But he's not coming to sacrifice this time. He's not coming to bring salvation to mankind. He's coming to end it. And he will end it. And that can't come soon enough for me. As we say all the time, come quickly, Lord Jesus. That was John's idea too. So again, doctrine of separation becomes an issue. Now, we don't live in a society now where we kill people who are teaching false doctrine. The worship of other gods. Let me think about that. That might be fun. No, that's not why we're here. Just like Jesus, he did not come to kill men, to destroy them. He came so that they might be saved. And that's our job, is to reflect that. So they might be saved. We want to offer them the word of life, the doctrine of the gospel. And then for believers, the doctrines of sound doctrine. Also, Matthew chapter 10. But we don't live in a society, of course, where we enforce capital punishment on the worship of other gods. But Israel did. And so Matthew chapter 10, 34 through 37. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a conflict. That's what sword means in this particular context. Sword can be used broadly. It's not technical. I mean, it sometimes it's used of the physical instrument, the sword. But sometimes it's used in other ways for like murder. It's used for capital punishment. It's used for dying in battle, the sword. Here, just more general is the idea, because he's not talking about dying in battle, not talking about capital punishment. He's talking about the opposite of peace, conflict. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And that's why back there in Deuteronomy says, if the one who's even as your own soul comes and entices you with false doctrine, or in their case, the worship of other gods, you're to deal with it and deal with it quickly and deal with it firmly and deal with it ruthlessly. But again, the people don't like the idea of a Jesus who would do that, because they've got this Jesus in their mind who wouldn't do that. And yet he stands right here and says that these are his words. I didn't make them up. These are exactly what he said. So again, neither of these is to take preference for your love for God, preference over it. So D, category four, love, love for enemies. This is where many people get confused. This category has caused a great deal of confusion in Christendom, since many do not understand that this is to be applied on a personal level and not on the corporate or national level. So in a society, this is interpersonal relationships among people, believers, us, but your neighbors out there, the people that live around you, the people you interact with. But again, this doesn't have to do with a capital punishment, say. So it's entirely inappropriate. It's inappropriate to even bring this up in the context of capital punishment because they're not even related. Love for your enemies doesn't mean that you tolerate criminal activity. So it's entirely inappropriate to apply this category of love toward criminal types who should receive justice. And whatever the sentence of the court was, and justice in our country is supposed to be speedy. We've got an amendment about that. You have the right to a speedy trial. What are they doing about Charlie Kirk? This isn't a speedy trial. This is a judge who's either an idiot or doesn't know what he's doing. One or the other. And what's the purpose of all of this? This is an affront to a normal civilized society. And then you have these activist judges turning criminals loose. I just saw they just deported this one guy, raped this girl for 2 years, 10 through 12, got convicted, went to prison, let him out, and then pardoned him. So now he's back on the streets. Well, Rubio swept him up, said, no, you're not. We're revoking your visa. You're gone. But they don't. The radical left doesn't even want that done. They want criminals coddled. They want them turned loose. They want no bail. This is the insanity that's gripped our world. And I think if it weren't for doctrine, I'd be completely a basket case. You wonder, how do people even deal with this out there? Knowing that they've released that the criminal justice system has become a joke in some way. One good thing in Florida, I like DeSantis. He's putting them to death one after the other. That's justice. And that ought to be televised in prime time, 9 o'clock. Everybody ought to be forced to watch it. Here's what happens if you take a gun and shoot somebody. You need to see what a death is like. Make these people watch this. That might deter somebody. You say, yeah, I wouldn't deter anybody. I don't know. You watch a guy doing the death rattle, you may think, well, once again, that could be me. So I'd hope people would think that way. So they're supposed to receive justice. Neither is it appropriate for enemies with whom the nation may be in conflict. Genesis 9, 5 and 6. Surely, I will require your lifeblood. This is coming out of the ark. This is instructions given to Noah directly from God. So this isn't man passed this, man made these laws. No, this is God directing the human race as to what the rules are. From every beast I will require it, and from every man. From every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood will be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And what it says when you kill somebody, you say, I don't care if they're in the image of God, I'm killing them anyway. And God takes an affront to that. God takes offense at that. And this is open-ended. Whoever does this, if you kill somebody, you forfeit your life. That's the rules. That's the biblical law. And just because our country doesn't enforce it doesn't make it any less true. And it should be enforced. And if it were enforced, but people have bought into the punishment is never a deterrent. It sure was when I was a child. How many of you were deterred from doing something because you knew you could get in trouble for it? Most people. That's how most of us grew up. So, again, this was, and by the way, it was incorporated here, coming out of the flood. Everybody that came out of that ark knew this. And yet it was quickly ruined by man, watered down to where they quit observing it. And that's not good at all. All right, well, our time's gone today. Let's go ahead and stop there, and we will continue here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth and future glory, for we ask in Christ's name. Amen. Mm-hmm.